Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the library for this afternoon's lecture. I'm delighted to invite Rob Stefanica, Secretary of DPS, to MC proceedings.
Thank you, Jonathan. Good afternoon. My name's Rob Stefanica. I'm the Secretary of the Department of Parliamentary Services. I'll be MC for this Parliamentary Library Fellowship Seminar on behalf of the Parliamentary Librarian, Dr. Diane Herriot, who unfortunately couldn't be here this afternoon. Air Chief Marshal Binskin, for Defence Forces guests, ladies and gentlemen. I'd like to begin this afternoon by acknowledging the traditional owners of the land on which we meet today, the Ngunnawal peoples. I pay my respects to the elders past and present, and I pay my respects to any Aboriginal or Torres Strait Islander people that may be here today. Welcome to Australian Parliament House and to the Parliamentary Library for today's lecture by Dr. Edward Scar, the 2015 Parliamentary Library Fellow. Before introducing Air Chief Marshal Binskin, I would like to give some background to the Parliamentary Fellowship Program. The Parliamentary Library has managed the Australian Parliamentary Fellowship on behalf of the Parliament since 1970. The aim of the program is to contribute to scholarship on the Parliament and issues of importance to parliamentarians. The value of the Fellowship lies not only in the delivery of a research monograph, but also in its potential to promote knowledge of the Parliament in the wider research community and in its immediate direct value to the Library and its clients. I'm now delighted to ask Air Chief Marshal Binskin, Chief of the Defence Force, to make some introductory comments. Air Chief Marshal Binskin was appointed as Chief of Defence Force on the 30th of June 2014 and previously served as Chief of the Air Force from 2008 to 11 and Vice Chief of the Defence Force from 2011 to 14. I would like to particularly express my appreciation to you for your support to Dr. Scar, both during his research and in taking time to participate in the lecture today. I think it reflects the importance that both the Parliament and the Australian Defence Force attached to this issue. Air Chief Marshal Binskin.
Thank you very much. And good afternoon, everyone. It's great to be here. And this is important to me, and I was very pleased that myself and members of the Australian Defence Force could support this, the development of what is for us a very important body of work. Since 2009, Defence has undertaken a significant amount of research to better understand the complexities of mental health so that we can better support our people. But to date, there's been very little independent research conducted in this particular area. So that was why we welcomed Dr. Scar's approach to do some independent research for us and be able to provide recommendations and areas that we might be able to improve in. Now, a substantial portion of Dr. Scar's research verifies in many ways what we already know. For example, the number of people in the ADF who are affected are in the minority. The people who experience mental health issues can, and do, and I know many of them, go on to have a meaningful and productive ADF career. And that ill-informed criticism of our support services adds to the stigma and deters people from seeking assistance. Our mental health care programs have come a long way over the past decade, though. And we have robust resilience in our programs in place and a comprehensive support system that's recognised as a benchmark for other uniform organisations across Australia. And we know more about military mental health now than we have at any time in our history. But there's always more that we can do to care for our people, and I'm always the first to acknowledge that. We're still working hard to find new ways to break down the stigma that prevents people from getting the support that they need. And we're committed to a program of ongoing development and improvement to ensure we meet the changing needs of our people as the Australian Defence Force's mission continues to evolve around the world. At the heart of everything we do are our people and their families, ensuring they have access to programs to support them through their recovery, providing meaningful opportunities to continue their military career if they choose, and ensuring the recognition they deserve for their service, no matter what the cause of their illness or their injury. And that remains my commitment. So on that note, I'd like to congratulate Edward and thank him for his contribution to what is an important national issue for the Australian Defence Force and, just as importantly, the broader Australian community. Edward, you should be congratulated, mate. It's a great body of work, and I look forward to the lecture today. Thank you.
Thank you, Air Chief Marshal Binskin. Dr. Edward Scar was selected as a 2015 Parliamentary Library Fellow to investigate attitudes to mental health in the ADF. There's been a growing awareness in the general Australian community of the significance of mental health over the past few years. This has, of course, been even more the case for the military profession, given Australia's many international deployments and for some combat operations. The recognition of the importance of this issue was a significant factor in why the members of the Library Subcommittee, comprising Ms. Gay Brodman, Mr. Angus Taylor, and Dr. Diane Herriot, selected Dr. Scar. Dr. Scar brought to the research both his academic experience, having received a PhD in sociology at ANU, and service as an officer in the Australian Army Reserve Service, which has included deployment to the Solomon Islands as a platoon commander. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Edward Scar to present his paper, Changing Attitudes to Mental Illness in the ADF. A long way to go. Thank you, Dr. Scar.
Look, thank you very much for those introductions. Thank you in particular to the Chief of the Defence Force, Air Chief Marshal Mark Binskin. I know that you have a long-standing interest in this issue. Thank you for making time in your schedule on Remembrance Day and for your support of this research. Thank you to each of you for your interest also in this research and in this issue. A couple of quick thank yous. A thank you to Dr. Diane Herriot, Jonathan Curtis and Nigel Brew of the Library that supported this research, and also my two academic advisors in this project, Dr. Alexander McFarlane and Dr. Timothy Kendall. Look, that is the cover of the research. As was introduced, it's on mental health of ADF personnel and veterans. That's the scope of what I'm going to talk at today for the next 30 minutes. I'm going to introduce the research, talk about the problem, talk about the issue of stigma, talk about prevention, and make some very general comments about the future. I was going to talk about the fellowship program, but I think that's been covered off. Look, it was a fantastic project program. It gave me the opportunity to contribute to the research of the Parliamentary Library and also to contribute to conversations around this issue. Look, I found myself here in January and talking to about a dozen people and casting around for ideas on the best way to approach this research. And one of them was Senator Jackie Lambie. I found myself in her office and her Chief of Staff said, look, next week, we're walking across Kokoda with a group of PTSD diagnosed veterans. You should absolutely come. So I spent 11 days on the Kokoda track with Senator Lambie and a group of veterans. That's a photo of us at the beginning of the track on day one. I got to know a group of those veterans very well and have recorded the stories of many of them in this research. And that experience has informed the way this research has gone. Look, this is a cartoon that I love. I came across it, I felt like it really made a very powerful message. I'll leave it on the screen, perhaps as I'm talking. I think it says something really distinctive and informative about attitudes we have to mental illness and the relationship between mental and physical illness. And stigma and prejudice towards mental illness. I hope you can see that slide. I'll leave it up while I'm talking. Mental health and defence is an expansive topic. It includes the work of multiple federal government departments and organisations, as well as the states as providers of service, but also broad and fluid societal attitudes. Military mental health remains a go-to topic for the media, as it was during this research last year. Soon after I began this research, a Four Corners episode titled Bringing the War Home aired on the 9th of March 2015. The headlines of that episode ran, "As Australians prepare to send more troops to the Middle East, there's a simple question. Are we doing enough to look after the people who have already served their country?" That program prompted a Senate inquiry. A couple of weeks later, on the 25th of March, the Senate referred the following matter to the Foreign Affairs, Defence and Trade Reference Committee for inquiry and report. The title was The Mental Health of Australian Defence Force Personnel Who Have Returned from Combat, Peacekeeping and Other Deployments. That inquiry received 82 submissions. They tabled their report on the 15th of March of this year. On the 15th of September, the government responded and agreed to the majority of the report's recommendations. Interestingly, there was a recommendation around moral injury. And currently there's no research going on moral injury that I'm aware of in an Australian context. Moral injury represents a wonderful opportunity to learn about issues that impact on the well-being of Defence Force personnel and veterans. The aim of this research is to highlight significant elements of the ongoing debate around mental health in the Australian Defence Force. It examines in particular the attitudes towards service provision and support available to serving and ex-serving ADF personnel, highlighting areas where improvements might be made. The aim was to highlight some of the most credible and trustworthy discourse on mental health in the ADF. There exist numerous ongoing challenges with regard to the health of military personnel and veterans, as evidenced by persistent and debilitating health concerns among these populations, and by the open acknowledgement of a range of professionals working in this area. A feature of debates around the mental health of serving and ex-serving ADF personnel is the apparent circular argument in the public discourse represented in the media, which runs as follows. The government sent these men and women to war. They have come back broken and is now refusing to look after them. These attacks make the government and the bureaucracy more defensive and reactive, and these running battles come to dominate discussion. The victimhood and entitlement mentality this has been seen to foster is not what veterans groups say their members ultimately want, nor is it compatible with long-term positive health outcomes post-military service. A circuit breaker is required to turn these circular debates, those that begin with personal narratives told through the media and to Parliament, which engage experts in the bureaucracy and back again, to a linear model of independent research leading to the development of evidence-based and best practice policy and service provision. The current system is failing a minority of veterans, and the manner in which this issue is being addressed in public debates is proving ultimately unhelpful, with some proposed solutions actually being counterproductive. Space must be made for a discussion on strategies not beholden to entrenched bureaucratic models that do not adequately consider what help these target groups need, nor how to get it to them. The comment was made to me by a senior academic working in this space that an independently planned research strategy with input from practitioners and academics is a vital but missing part of what is occurring at present, and this needs to be made a priority for government. This would include an ongoing commitment to research designed to assess the needs of veterans in a way that genuinely engages the unique aspects of the culture of this population, informing the design of strategies for prevention, early intervention and treatment. An independently planned research agenda, informed by subject matter experts, open to external scrutiny, where experts are encouraged to be critical of poor practices when they are identified. An umbrella framework is required to ensure that numerous diverse groups working in this environment can make a meaningful contribution to a whole, to ensure a commonality of effort, to foster collaboration, innovation and development, and eliminate redundancy. A starting point for the development of end-user-focused solutions is the experience of serving military personnel and veterans. An appreciation of the experience of these populations, combined with the application of a rigorous research methodology, is useful in better understanding the needs of veterans and the best way of implementing treatment models. Much of the current debate predominantly features highly emotive accounts of disaffected veterans, but without a framework through which to understand these personal narratives, combative and reactive cultures flourish. What is required is to recognise and do justice to the experience of these veterans, constituting a form of unrefined truth, is the application of a methodological framework to transform these experiences from personal tragedies to starting points for the development of meaningful solutions. While much progress has been made, a disconnect continues to exist between some of the services available in the intended recipient communities. A consequence of the outsourcing of and divestment of health assets and services by both Defence and DVA over the last decade is that there is a perceived lack of internal accountability regarding gaps in service provision. While the states and private sector are the providers of care, no systematic approach exists to understand and meet the complex needs of veterans. The gamut of issues around mental health in defence is complex, poorly understood and easily misrepresented. Unique features of the military include it being the only profession that requires its workforce to train for and carry out the killing of people and the destruction of property as part of its core business. This is thought to carry with it unique challenges to the non-physical elements of the well-being of the men and women who choose this profession. For this research, I spoke to over 100 people with subject matter expertise in military mental health. 76 of them are acknowledged and quoted from in this report. The objective was to distill some common elements in the debate on mental health and defence from among the many and varied and often contradictory views held by experts with different professional perspectives. Additional aims of the study included the generation of concepts that could indicate useful areas of exploration rather than developing firm recommendations. Interview-based research on a small scale is intentionally designed to generate concepts. While the sample size is very small and caution is required in interpreting the findings, the account of veterans interviewed do complement the views of experts consulted. As an exploratory study, the aim has been to formulate concepts rather than verify conclusions. Look, I won't read those, but they were some of the broad research questions that informed this study. Look, just a note on terminology. The casual use of stigmatising language relating to mental health is everywhere. From throwaway descriptions of best friends as being totally mad to a busy weekend as being mental. Much of the language that is commonly used to describe mental health conflicts with a focus on strength-based and recovery-oriented outlook. A focus on language that is respectful to people who have experienced reduced mental fitness and the promotion of communication that focuses on recovery and personal empowerment has all kinds of benefits. Correcting the terminology used is not about political correctness, but recognising that language has an impact on shaping and reflecting currents of thought and feelings towards this issue. It also sends an important message about considering those whose lives have been affected. I have used the term mental fitness in this report as a term that carries less baggage and enables a focus on well-being, as one suggested to me by Major General Jeffrey Singleman. Look, this slide has some statistics on it from the 2010 ADF Mental Health and Wellbeing Study. While there are significant gaps in available statistics, what we do know comes from Defence and DVA-funded research. In particular, the study I just mentioned and the Middle East Area of Operations, MEO, Census Perspective Health Studies of 2013. Lifetime rates for mental disorders in the ADF are considerably higher than the Australian community, with over 54% of ADF personnel experiencing a disorder in their lifetime. We know that mental health in the ADF is part of a much larger context of mental health in the Australian society. For example, PTSD affects a much wider population than veterans of combat or defence. First responders are routinely exposed to traumatic circumstances, and Indigenous children are routinely exposed to... experience disproportionately high rates of psychological injury as a result of exposure to trauma. The State and Federal Police, Department of Veterans Affairs... the Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade and aid agency workers are other groups thought to experience abnormally high rates of psychological trauma. The fallout from unrecognised psychological injuries are thought to include increased incidence of self-harm, alcohol and drug abuse, domestic violence, incarceration, homelessness, early death and suicide. A quote from Alan Bem, who's the CEO of Fearless, said, "One observation is that homeless, displaced veterans have replaced swagmen of a bygone era and are self-treating with suicide. A feature of debates around this issue, however, is that little data exists to support claims being made about the prevalence of these kinds of consequences of military service. There is ongoing Defence and DVA-funded research on those issues. A complicating element in the manner in which there is often a delayed onset of symptoms associated with PTSD and comorbidities. This creates a set of challenges that include difficulties in linking exposure to trauma with symptoms, both from a veteran's perspective and in official bureaucratic processes. With low rates of mental health literacy and an inability to identify when help may be required, a situation may become chronic, with the individual feeling increasingly helpless before the case comes to the attention of the medical community or DVA. Records can be patchy, and an already unwell veteran may find themselves having to retell their story numerous times in an adversarial setting, where the onus of proof is on them to demonstrate that they are deserving. Another feature of the system are parliamentary committees that pit generals, politicians against bureaucrats, well practiced at deflecting attention and criticism, with strategies such as ruling lines of inquiry outside of their respective administrative remits. Most senior bureaucrats are not subject matter experts in mental health, meaning the responses they give often do not clarify anything or accurately inform the politicians regarding their concerns. Constant attacks and accusations, both by the media and politicians, have had the effect of making inherently insular cultures of the bureaucracy more defensive. The adversarial nature of the hearings only increase reactive and defensive responses. When politicians and journalists sense something is amiss but cannot get straight answers, progress is stifled and the same circularity is perpetuated. A program of independent and best practice research may be one of the key elements in breaking the circular manner in which this issue is played out at present. Anyone experiencing reduced mental fitness, including defence members and veterans, are relatively powerless, and while stories of wounded veterans are picked up by the media, it remains the case that Defence and DVA do not really know what to do with serving members and veterans whose health has been adversely affected in this way. A quote from a colleague and researcher on mental health, Paula Dabovich, said, "Defence might have the best policies, but if they are not well understood or accepted by the target population, they are essentially a waste of time." A gap in the research exists regarding how soldiers feel about the treatment and services available and what they actually want. The claim being made is not that policymakers should be dictated to by a small, disgruntled group, but that research into culturally appropriate service provision is an important but missing component of a well-informed approach to improving the experiences of those who feel that existing services have not been designed with their needs in mind. Part of this puzzle is the relationship between the federal government's coordination and state-based service provision. State-based health systems can be fragmented due to the nature of the system that support them. Some likewise regard the federal system as fragmented in that defence and DVA are separate and not always successful in working seamlessly together. From a political perspective, although the consolidation and coordination of these systems appear to offer efficiency dividends, this will require political will to achieve. This slide represents some of the ways in which some of the key ways in which this issue is rehearsed in Parliament. The Parliament, as a key national institution, plays a significant role in shaping attitudes on the treatment of military personnel and veterans and their mental health care. However, there is no formal reporting mechanism between the bureaucracy and the Parliament devoted solely to the ADF to ADF mental health. Parliamentary interest in the issue does come up in other ways. Within parliamentary processes. An encouraging note is the work being done by the 2nd Commando Regiment and the approach it has taken to the mental fitness of its workforce. There are elements of this that provide an example of what is possible, albeit on a small and highly specialised workforce of elite soldiers. The regiment has been successful at substantially reducing the stigma around reduced mental fitness and offering meaningful support to transitioning members in a culturally relevant way. Among the strategies adopted by this group is the provision of services and support by BEREC-qualified members of their own unit who have had first-hand experience of service-related non-physical injuries. The view taken by the 2nd Commando Regiment is that each individual represents such a significant capability that should their capacity be reduced for any preventable reason, including loss of mental fitness, it should be identified as quickly as possible, resources marshalled, and appropriate care and support be given to get that individual back working as soon as possible. One of the strategies used for achieving this end is the human performance wing. And that human performance wing, HPW, have developed a handbook. Here's a couple of extracts from it. It was pointed out to me that the Australian Regular Army has soldier recovery centres, which at first glance looked like the 2nd Commando Regiment model of high performance wing. However, it was described during interviews for this research as being outside the unit's chain of command. And while the high performance wing is about individual results and outcomes, the soldier recovery centres become dumping grounds for unwanted and discharging soldiers. The soldier recovery centres are often staffed by non-commissioned officers and commanders who have no experience with mental fitness issues, therefore furthering opportunities for misunderstandings and stigma to flourish. A senior commander of 2nd Commando Regiment stated to me in an interview that while the 2nd Commando Regiment is doing mental health well, it's an indictment on the ADF, not a positive for 2nd Commando. Psychiatrist and specialist in veterans' mental health Andrew Koo stated his belief that the stigma surrounding mental health in the ADF is our biggest challenge, and that the single biggest difference that could be made to mental health outcomes in military personnel would be to identify unwell individuals earlier and then maintain them in effective treatments. Andrew Koo believes that dealing with stigma is a more urgent issue than even treatment development. In a culture that lauds strength and shuns weakness, the cultural change necessary to convince serving personnel to seek help is significant. That was a quote by Senator Linda Reynolds. A culture that values strength and preparedness to help others before oneself, qualities that make a good soldier, leaves defence personnel and veterans vulnerable to a reluctance to seek treatment for symptoms of psychological injuries when they occur. This is coupled with a defence culture that views such injuries as weakness and tantamount to malingering. Further complicating the issue is that a diagnosis of a psychological injury is often thought to lead to misdeployments and promotion windows and result in involuntary discharge on medical grounds. There is a pervasive fear that a diagnosis of mental illness will unreasonably result in misdeployments, denied promotions, and most likely lead to discharge. This combined with the fact that such injuries can be hidden means defence has a negative attitude or culture around mental health that may result in large numbers of psychologically injured personnel not receiving treatment. While no one is arguing that those with reduced mental fitness require support or treatment as a priority over career considerations, it is widely acknowledged by working professionals both within and outside the ADF that the stigma of mental illness is a significant additional barrier to an ADF career than a medical issue alone. There is a perception that the ADF have a culture that encourages its workforce to hide mental and physical injuries. Left untreated, psychological injuries and reduced mental fitness can have wide-reaching negative impacts on personal well-being. It touches every aspect of a person's life, including their social and emotional well-being, as well as their cognitive functioning. Increased awareness that war can have negative psychological effects and this constitutes an entirely normal human reaction normalises psychological injury. Likewise, a formal diagnosis can at times be unhelpful, stigmatising and make the situation worse and works to medicalise what might be social or moral problems. Suggested solutions include the need for a highly targeted stigma reduction measures because a message that reaches one target group will be ineffective with other groups. Andrew Koo believes that one of the most important things that will convince serving defence personnel to seek treatment for mental health related issues is to see others do it, resolve the issue with treatment and successfully return to work, thus fostering a justified belief that mental injuries will be treated like physical ones. This next section is a key observation in this research report. Prevention relies on reducing the risk factors for mental disorder, as well as enhancing the predictive factors that promote mental health. Universal interventions are aimed at improving the overall mental health of a population. An example would be programs aimed at building mental health literacy across all personnel in all services as part of an integrated mental health awareness raising process. This may not only reduce the rates and fallout of reduced mental fitness, but potentially result in a reduction of treatment and compensation expenditure. The National Mental Health Commission argues that the reallocation of resources to upstream services, including prevention and funding outcomes rather than activity. The World Health Organization describes prevention as one of the most obvious ways to alleviate the burdens of related mental disorders. They link mental disorders to human rights issues, which demonstrates how pervasive the effects of stigma, discrimination, and human rights violations are. It is wrongly believed that no effective treatment modalities exist. Preventative strategies can therefore not only impact the well-being of those affected, but also combat the stigma associated with disorders of this kind. Defence has a number of programs in place that incorporate elements of preventative mental health approaches. Examples include the Battle Smart program, suicide prevention presentations as part of yearly annual training, and veterans and veterans family counselling service and mental health day activities. It was put to me that these programs represent an ad hoc approach to preventative mental health care, where best practice and culturally appropriate prevention strategies do not exist. Making them research priorities will help close the gap in the literature and improve service provision. It was put to me that while little evidence of substantive preventative mental health measures being put in place and routinely used to good effect in the ADF. While some preventative services do exist, little is known about the way in which the target groups access these services or how effective the services are at combating rates of reduced mental fitness. Military officers often talk about resilience as a preventative approach to the mental well-being of their workforce. However, prevention and resilience are not synonymous. A focus on resilience is a double-edged sword in that while it may better prepare a soldier for duty, it may also inadvertently set them up for failure. When a defence member becomes unwell, it may further entrench stigmatising attitudes. If they are seen to lack resilience or made to feel that it is something that they should have been able to overcome. In addition to resilience, there is an urgent need for an increased focus on other forms of psychological preventative measures and increased mental health literacy. And that's a quote by David Dunt. An American study on prevention strategies and treatment of mental illness in the military recommends that only evidence-based resilience, prevention and reintegration programs and policies be employed, and that not evidence-based programming be eliminated. It argues that where programming needs exist and the evidence base is insufficient, rigorous methods should be used to develop, test, monitor and evaluate new programming. The knowledge gap in the evidence for prevention and mental health approaches is one that needs to be filled so that it can become part of the business as usual for the ADF. Additional investment in psychological injury prevention represents an opportunity. A characteristic of debates around mental health in the ADF is the multitude of divergent groups with different and often contradictory views. This creates a set of political, social and administrative challenges for government. The task of integrating and coordinating the competing voices is significant. Leadership with authority and a capacity to bring these disparate voices together while forging a path forward that engages people appears to be an essential element in optimising the potential of those who wish to contribute. Currently, no forum exists where which the scope of the problem can be clearly defined and effective solutions planned. Such a forum would allow for the development of a new narrative focused on a professionally set agenda. The issue of mental health of current serving ADF members and veterans is one that will always evoke a range of opinions and tensions between the organisation and individuals with vested interests. One challenge arising for policymakers is how to engage the development of high-quality research and audit arrangements to provide an objective analysis of emerging and current concerns. This process depends on finding ways to facilitate collaborative dialogue between veterans, ex-service organisations, federal government departments, state-based health departments, the medical profession and politicians. The landscape of veterans' mental health is constantly changing in terms of demographics, the number and duration of deployments, the type of wars being fought and the evolution of the health system. As such, these issues require ongoing monitoring to achieve optimised outcomes for both veterans themselves and the public. While we've come a long way from a very low starting point, the programs and services available are not yet fully effective, and without significant investment in this issue, there is the risk that the stakes of the Vietnam War will be replicated, creating another long legacy of psychological injury from recent and current deployments. And just a final thought. This is the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, 5th edition. It's the Bible of mental disorders for psychiatrists and psychologists. PTSD is an instructive example from the DSM. We know that interest taken in this issue of PTSD is high following significant military operations and by governments and the mental health community. However, we know that this interest wanes. PTSD as a diagnosis first appeared in the official nomenclature of the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, Volume 1, published in 1952. It was then called Gross Stress Reaction. It was omitted, however, in the next edition in 1968 after a long period of relative peace. While DSM-3 was being developed in the mid-1970s, the recent occurrence of the Vietnam War provoked a more thorough examination of the disorder. PTSD, in something resembling its current form, first appeared in DSM-3 in 1980. And more recently, its definition has changed in the DSM-4 and our current DSM 2013. The challenge is to break the cycle of professional interest in this issue waxing and waning corresponding to the waging of war. Thank you very much.
At this point, does anybody have any questions for Dr. Scar?
Yes.
Thanks, Ed. That was really interesting, and it's been good to see how your research has developed from those early discussions we had when you first came to the library. I wonder, did your research at all encompass best practice models in other countries' defence forces and how they develop programs for their uniformed personnel? I'm thinking of countries like in Scandinavian countries, the Netherlands, those sorts of places. Did you explore any of their approaches?
Look, not directly, but we do know that, for example, best practice first frontline treatments for PTSD are consistent internationally. The challenge, as I understand it, comes through implementation. And so while there are examples of countries that do mental health and their militaries very well, what prevents us from copying their models is characteristics of our own health system. Rather than being able to sort of cut and paste another model, there are intricacies of our own system that mean that adjusting service provision for our own sort of unique system is important.
Just in terms of the attitudes you mentioned earlier, the range of other groups such as first responders, emergency services and so forth, do you have any sense from your research of what their attitude, their kind of organisational attitudes are to mental health, mental fitness, trauma and so forth?
Look,
not so much their treatments of, but those cultural attitudes.
Yeah, we know that there's increasing sort of awareness and those other organisations and institutions that you mentioned are sort of increasingly focused on that aspect of the well-being of their workforce. We know that comparatively, defence do very well, and other first-line responding organisations, for example, are envious of the way that defence care for its workforce in terms of their mental health.
Can I have a follow-up, or is that another
one? I might actually interrupt and offer maybe a closing thanks to Edwin. I'm Paul Paddy, and I represent about 15,000 veterans of the Overwatch organisation. The CDF is probably quite sick of hearing of us over the time, because we're continually raising the fact that Edward's research talks about people that are our brothers in arms. I'm a recent veteran, and I've worked with Edward to produce some of the data that will go into his report, and I'll take it now back to my interested members and the current department that I'm the Chief of Staff in, who wear a uniform, and we'll use this very well-founded and tested research to make some changes for those people that are suffering now, and hopefully to prevent the next population of people that wear any colour uniform from suffering again. And while I respect that we have done a great job for those of us who've served, we need to do better. So thank you, Edward, on behalf of 15,000 members of the Australian Border Force who will be benefiting from this research, and the members of the Overwatch group who are the current sufferers. I thank you for putting your effort into a document that I know that will go towards remediating mental health, because it will allow us to understand what we're going through. Thanks.
Jonathan, did you think you had a follow-up?
I was just going to ask, I know your research focus largely, if not exclusively, on the Army, correct me if I'm wrong. Did you see any particular differences in the sorts of sources of trauma across the three services and their quite distinctive cultures, and therefore how that rolls out in both attitudes and best practice responses?
No, look, excellent question. And look, I can't answer that in terms of differences between the services. I guess I got a strong sense, though, from talking to particularly the medical community that that are interested in military mental health, that the issues of stigma and potentially the opportunity around prevention is sort of consistent across the services.
I mean, I give an observation. I have the best benchmark system in the world. If I can't break down the stigma, it's not going to be able to help people, and that's really the key, which I think is also a point of view.
I don't think we want to investigate the avenue that you're going down. We're trying very hard to unify the community out there. Because, to paraphrase Edward's findings, when you live inside a first-line response organisation that isn't politically aligned, every factor that you presented is what I hear every time I take a call from a young veteran about committing suicide. But I'm trying to stop. Stigma, they don't know what's wrong, they don't know where to go. And it doesn't matter how many times the CDF mentions to every officer under his command, make sure you get the message down. There's always some little private soldier in a combat support battalion in Townsville that doesn't get the message. So we don't want to make this debate more granular. I think we need to unify it and treat everybody as an equal issue, which goes to the remediation strategy that you presented.
No, this is going to fall some boiling water on the cat or something. I'm a bit worried about the recent development in the United States forces, in which there seems to be a tension between treating the passion on one end, which would be okay, different and so on, but the other thing is some psychologists and some part of it are much more concerned about the loss that highly important, highly costly training can do when the soldier becomes incapacitated. And they developed a treatment, not so much to treat the soldiers, but to make sure that they restore so the capacity to work in a stressful situation. That treatment is, well, you could say highly unethical, but it seems to work on the short term. They basically put the affected soldier in virtual environment which reproduce the circumstances of the trauma, and they do that repeatedly till the soldier believe it's a treatment, but it's not, you see. The soldier become inured, fill up to capacity, and it will end up the reflexes, the defensive reflexes, or whatever reflexes the army train to make that soldier efficient, start working again. The long term of the soldiers are completely up in the air. But it's a treatment which has become, I shouldn't say the word treatment, it's a way to react to the problem that save the investment of the defense force into the training of a soldier, but doesn't give any kind of thought to the long-term health of the soldier. Now, if you concentrate it on veteran, you may not have had the occasion to see that kind of divergence in aim, whether treating the soldiers or saving the army investment in training and so on and so forth. I'm just wondering if you had encountered anything that tells about the tensions between different goals for treatment.
Yeah, look, it's a fascinating question. Look, not being a clinician, it's difficult for me to comment on individual treatment models.
The research is quite new, I mean, just a few years old.
Yeah, it does sound like what you're getting at, though, is sort of broader sort of moral implications of it all
and
treatment goals.
Yeah,
look, I think there's a real opportunity for more research around the moral implications of many of these questions.
Mostly it's cognitive psychologists doing that work.
Yeah, look, thanks for making that point.
Congratulations on the project, then. I was struck by a comment you made about the uniqueness of the military environment as opposed to other environments, about the training being to kill or destroy. And it did strike me as I hadn't ever considered in those terms, but how important that is, and should more of the focus of mental fitness be about at the training end, as opposed to treating the problems at the other end, or what precisely can be done at that the sort of training end rather than fixing the problem at the other end?
Yeah, look, I'm glad you raised that. There are some programs in place around mental health awareness and mental health literacy, defensive training personnel in mental health first aid, but we know that there's an evidence gap around preventative measures, and there's a real opportunity to bridge that gap with research. There's some really smart money that can be spent on preventative measures that prevent the kind of debilitating psychological injuries that can ruin people's lives. So a reason that there's a low take-up of preventative measures is there isn't best practice evidence-based off-the-shelf treatments available. So developing those represents a real opportunity, it seems to me. Does that answer?
Yeah. It just strikes me as a very crucial variable in the overall situation. The bar is much higher because you're dealing with something that is a rather traumatic thing to be training people in. So.
Mm. The data, before we commenced our long war, what information were you able to gather in relation to that, and how do you view the changes of things such as 80th Mental Health Day and things along those lines in relation to removing the stigma about mental health?
Look, that's a great point. And we know we've come a very long way from a very low starting point. There are now devoted programs around this, and that represents a significant improvement in what's happened sort of even in recent decades. So People are talking about this issue. Senior commanders take an interest in this issue, and that represents sort of a significant benefit to mental health levels in veterans.
Any further questions?
All right.
Thank you, Dr. Scar. When I read your paper last night, it struck a particular chord with me as well. In 2001, I was committee secretary to a select committee on mental health in New South Wales. It's interesting, the two themes recurred in that inquiry that you've struck 15 years later. And that is the stigma associated with acknowledging support of mental health issues, and the other is the accessibility to appropriate services. That's not just services, but appropriate services that are suitable for those with complex needs. At the conclusion of that inquiry, the chair of that select committee, Dr. Brian Pizzuti, who's a medical doctor and a defence reservist himself, stated there must be no wrong door when it comes to people with a mental illness who attempt to access health services. So I'm not surprised that 15 years later we still have a fair way to go as public servants and as a community. But it's clear that progress has been made, and it should give us cause for optimism. The conversation has at least started, which is a massive first step. So I thank you all for attending today, and thank you again, Dr. Scar. And for those of you that have time, you're more than welcome to hang around and have a chat over afternoon tea. Thank you.
Well done.